Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. All the Real Indians Died Off is the book we're putting the spotlight on this month. Each chapter examines different myths connected to Native lifeways. The authors contend Native Americans and Alaska Natives are often seen as invisible people in the collective consciousness of many societies worldwide. It's their hope this book will help turn things around. We'll connect you directly to our November Book of the Month right after National Native News. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Observers say early voting is down this year in Native communities in South Dakota. Lee Strubinger reports.
In a close congressional race with national implications, a strong Native vote can sway elections. Some political analysts point to that in 2002, for example. A strong Native turnout helped Tim Johnson keep his U.S. Senate seat in a race against then-challenger John Thune. Fall River County Auditor Sue Ganji also oversees Oglala Lakota County elections. She says this year's early voter turnout is low due to voting locations, construction, and lack of funding to drive Natives to the polls.
We are seeing a lesser turnout than we've had in the past, but I think the bigger problem is in the past, it seems like political parties or whatnot provide some funding to get drivers to take voters to the polls, and from what I'm understanding, that money is not there this year.
Ganji says despite low turnout, early voting will continue at the Sue Ann Big Crow Center in Pine Ridge. O.J. Siemens is with the group Four Directions. He says GOTV, or Get Out the Vote efforts, require funding that isn't there this year.
One of the things that always affects Indian country more than anything else is whether or not there is a highly contested race in South Dakota. If there isn't a highly contested race, basically any donors that may be out there that want to help turn out the Native vote, don't donate to South Dakota.
The Secretary of State's office says that low voter turnout is also the result of a high number of ballot issues to vote on this year. Voters are spending more time studying all 10 measures before voting. I'm Lee Strubinger in South Dakota.
A ballot measure in Alaska would automatically register residents to vote. Reporter Allison Herrera tells us more.
The proposed ballot measure works like this. When Alaskans register to get their annual state fund check, they'll automatically be registered to vote. It's something Sarah Obed says will save time and bring in almost 70,000 new voters. Obed works for one of the Alaska Native corporations, which is working with other organizations to improve voting among Alaska Natives. Obed attended the Alaska Federation of Natives conference, where Alaska Natives, state political leaders, and heads of corporations all spoke up publicly in favor of ballot measure one.
We want every Alaska Native person and every Alaskan really to feel empowered to get to the polls.
She and others are using this ballot measure to promote Get Out the Native Vote. The initiative has drawn almost no opposition, but that doesn't mean it's not without its critics. Paul Jenkins is a conservative columnist and the editor of the online news site The Anchorage Daily Planet. He says it could lead to voter fraud and is suspicious of all the outside money and support the ballot measure has drawn.
Look who's paying for it. National Teachers Union is paying for most of it. Democrats, it's a Democratic operation. And of course they want voter registration to increase in Alaska, but especially in rural Alaska, where Democrats hold sway.
The ballot measure will cost nearly $1 million to implement, but supporters like Obed say it's worth it. If people vote yes, she says, it will be a permanent win for Alaska Natives who go to the polls every election, and she and others can focus on other things.
Voter turnout, voter education, voter awareness, how to vote in terms of the processes, also when to vote, and so we can basically focus our efforts to empowering people, encouraging people to vote.
For National Native News, I'm Allison Herrera.
Donald Trump Jr. is scheduled to campaign on the Navajo Nation this afternoon in the community of Shiprock, New Mexico. The Navajo Republican rally will include local, state, and national political leaders. On Sunday, the Trump campaign announced its Native American coalition, which includes chairs from the Navajo and Cherokee Nations and the Porch Creek Band, and lists more than 24 members. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
As an American Indian or Alaska Native, you help elders, young people, and Native businesses when you exercise your right to vote. Your vote makes a difference in Washington and at home. More information at nativenews.net, brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Support by VisionMaker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. VisionMaker Media celebrates 40 years by streaming 40 films in 40 weeks. More information, including titles and dates, can be found at visionmakermedia.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood. Have you ever wondered where myths about our Native nations come from? Have you ever heard things like, Europeans brought civilization to Native nations? What about Thanksgiving proves Native people welcome the pilgrims? What kind of roots do you think things like this are sprouted from? And maybe more pressing, how do these kind of statements affect you in your daily life? These questions are a couple of things that are examined in our November Book of the Month. The authors call them myths and do a great job of going into depth on why they exist and just how they've touched the lives of Indigenous people. And as we open the hour to our authors, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker, and their book, All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, we also want you to chime into the discussion, too. Tell us what myths about your tribal nations have stirred up in your life. The number to join us is 1-800-99-NATIVE or 1-800-996-2848. And the first 10 callers to make it on air will get a complimentary copy of the book, courtesy of Beacon Press. And all you have to do is share your thoughts on air or ask your questions. And we're ready for your calls now. Let's go ahead and welcome our guests. Joining us here in Studio 49 is Dina Gilio Whitaker. This Colville writer is known for her work with Indian Country Today Media Network. She's also a writer and researcher in Indigenous Studies and is currently a research associate and associate scholar at the Center for Indigenous Studies. Dina, welcome to the hour.
Hi, Tara. Thanks for having us.
Indeed. Also here in Studio 49 is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and she is a historian, author, and editor of 8 books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States. And she is also the recipient of the 2015 American Book Award. It's also our pleasure to welcome you to the hour as well, Roxanne.
Thank you, Tara.
Well, ladies, this book couldn't have come at a better time. I think there's so much going on in our tribal nations, just in the world in general. It's November a lot of time. People turn their attention to Native history, and sometimes the myths, they get bigger and they get a little more wild, as some would say. So ladies, let's go ahead and jump right into this. Right in my hands, I have the book that takes on over a dozen myths, as they're called. And I think they're statements that if you were to go throughout our Native nations and just throw any one, you could probably strike up a conversation with almost any generation. And that's exciting, too. So let's hear a little bit about the fuel behind this and how this project got started. Roxanne, let's start with you.
Thank you, Tara. I was thinking, too, that it's exciting, but it's also kind of sad that these myths have such a long life. Some of them are fading more than others, but some are too much alive and well. Yes, the book Beacon Press has a series of myth-busting books. So there's one on immigration, there's one on labor unions, and ours is the third number in that series. So there's a formula of 21 myths. We didn't settle on that random number ourselves. We fit this into a template, And I was dubious about it at first, and now I think it's just brilliant. You know, the template we had, we were restricted to work within, because each chapter, each myth is autonomous. You don't have to read this book in order, you know, from beginning to end, 10 pages each, and you can read them here and there. And then we have a historical timetable, which can anchor you, you know, if you want to go consult what was going on at that period of time. In general, to give a context. So I think it's very useful for all kinds of work for teachers at almost every level, to either use as it is or talk from, and talk about myths, get discussion going. It raises discussion. And also people who hold these myths, maybe not the more pernicious ones, but, you know, some of them, that have no idea that they're offensive or stereotypical or just not accurate. So I think the book is going to, yes, be useful, especially at this time when people hopefully are engaged with what is going on in one place, and they are aware that all these Native people have come from all over North America together there. This seems such a surprise to people, but of course it happens all the time. And I just think of the powwow circuit or other things, as if everyone's very isolated from each other. So I think it's really, really a good time to have this as a resource.
Indeed. And it goes into detail. You don't just throw out a myth and get folks excited about it. You really start to explain where some of this comes from, how it affects Native people. Something that I really enjoyed was the reference to current day issues, things that have gone on, that you examine each of these myths. Dina, is there anything you want to start us off with to give folks a really clear view of what they find in these pages?
Yeah, I'd say where this is coming from is it really comes out of Native studies. So Roxanne and I are both Native Studies scholars. I mean, she's been teaching. She taught for decades. She helped really found the field of ethnic studies and Native studies, and even here in Albuquerque at UNM. And I came out of that program at UNM. And so I went from the Native Studies program at UNM to the American Studies program as a grad student here. And so we've really taken those two perspectives, you know, academic perspectives, and Roxanne's expertise as a historian, and really melded them together to create, you know, as we say in the book, a counter narrative to the myths that have been really foisted on us, right? I mean, we didn't dream these things up. I mean, these are, and as we make it clear in the book that the myths themselves are the reflective of settler society. So we take as our starting point the concept of settler colonialism as a framework for within which that Native people today exist. And in that framework of settler colonialism is how these myths have evolved.
And something I think is a quick takeaway once you start getting through the book is these things that you're prompting readers to explore are leading to the invisibility of Native nations. And I want to hear more about that. But folks, I want to remind you, you can also join the conversation. If you'd like to talk directly with these authors, you can. The number is 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And the first 10 callers on air will receive a complimentary copy of the book. And we look forward to hearing from folks across our Native nations. If you'd like to join us again, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. So Dina, tell me more about this invisibility.
So in the framework of settler colonialism, and we have the eminent scholar, the late Patrick Wolf, who really gave this to us about a decade ago. This really surfaced in some of the academic disciplines. And he said that settler colonialism is a structure, not a historic event. I mean, so it goes beyond being an event toward a structure that states, modern states, have built on. And the goal of settler colonialism is always the acquisition of indigenous lands. And what it does in that acquisition of lands is eliminate the native. So the elimination of the native takes a lot of different forms. It can be genocide, actual genocidal war, but it also takes all these other different forms as it morphs into assimilation is one form of eliminating the native by eliminating native as like a political category, for example, as an identity.
And when you say the word genocide, that's even one of the myths that you both take on in the book. It's myth 8. The United States did not have a policy of genocide. Do you feel that's a myth? Call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. Ladies, we're going to take some calls. Let's go ahead and say hello to Roy in Akiak, Alaska, tuned in on KYUK. Thanks for joining us, Roy. And go ahead, you're on air.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. Since you have spent so many years studying about Native issues, what's your concept about people, you've described it earlier about other people coming in from different countries and attempt to make us like them. In other words, civilized. So since it's about the myths, about people coming in from other areas, outsiders, you might say, describing and making description of us in reference to us not being civilized. So what is your definition of civilization in reference to what is humane, civil, and environmental issues? In other words, trying to make life, living beings alive.
All right, Roy, thank you for your call. And ladies, let's go ahead and jump into that.
I immediately thought of what Gandhi said when a journalist asked him, what do you think of Western civilization? And he says, I think it's a good idea. And civilization sounds like a good thing. I call the pre-colonial civilizations of the Americas more advanced than where Europe was at the time of the at the time of Columbus in the 15th century, and in that civilization meaning very ordered societies, and I think there were these three centers of civilization in the Western Hemisphere, in the Andes, in Central America, Mexico, and the eastern half of North America, that were agriculturally advanced. All the products that people eat now, like everything Italian, the corn, the beans, the tomatoes, the squash, the pumpkins, everything was created by native farmers. And those are... that's the definition they use for European civilization. They start with the Tigris, Euphrates. They don't start with the Danube, and say that it developed from there. They appropriate something that isn't there. But then those civilizations in the Tigris, Euphrates, Nile River area, very much like the civilizations in the Americas at the time, only there was something different, and it has persisted in native cultures despite the centuries of colonialism, and that is human relations with each other, not going toward individualism and selfishness, because really survival depends on mutual assistance and caring for one another. That was never absent in these civilizations. And that's a big difference from, what developed in Europe.
Thanks for that, Roxanne. Let's go ahead and take another call. And Roy, also thank you for your call. Let's go ahead and hear now from Marcy in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Marcy, thanks for calling. And what would you like to share?
Hi. I have been an elementary teacher, and I'd like to ask your authors what they would recommend as a way of celebrating the students' Native culture during Thanksgiving. And I can take my answer offline.
All right. Thank you for your call, Marcy. And folks, if you're wanting to join us too, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Dina, your thoughts on that?
Well, get the book and read this chapter that we have on Thanksgiving and how we approach it. I think educators are really asking these questions more and more. I know, certainly Native educators and non-Native educators too, they know that the story is it's incorrect. It needs to be corrected, but how to teach that. And I would say that there's a Debbie Reese has a website. Roxanne, what's the website called?
Yeah, you just Google Debbie Reese and it comes up first thing on Google.
Yeah, and she's got this amazing website that is it's like a massive literature review. That's what she does. She looks at books on different topics that relate to Native people, and she analyzes them in depth, ruthlessly. And so that's really the best place to go.
And it's children and young adult books that she analyzes. And Debbie Reese, R-E-E-S-E, is from Nambe Pueblo.
Sure. She has a great website. She's probably listening right now and tweeting that we just talked about her and made her ears itch.
Yes.
Debbie does great work. And, I think you also both pay tribute to people who are doing good work in Native Nations. I think reading this book, my list of reading grew. You talk about other authors or scholars who have written on some of these subjects in the book. And why was it important to kind of give that kind of shout out as well?
Well, number one, our publisher Beacon Press is not an academic press in the conventional sense, it's a trade press publisher, but they specialize in social justice issues, and so the books that they publish need to be based, pretty much academically based. I kind of think of it as academia light, to make it accessible to a general readership. That's really who they're targeting, the people that may not have backgrounds in the kinds of academic disciplines that we're talking about. But so Roxanne.
Well, I what I feel is that I don't think this book or my previous book 2 years ago on Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, there's no way I could have written that book even maybe 15 years ago, because I was writing books and I wasn't writing that one. It is built upon this Native scholarship like Dina, who come out of universities and schools, who feel this commitment still to make what they have learned, their knowledge, to share it. So I think it's just automatic paying tribute. I can't everything in this is what knowledge that's been generated and enunciated, and we're able to compress it into sometimes a more readable form because of academia, the kind of formula that is required in academia sometimes makes it inaccessible to, but the ideas are all there. So it's definitely, it's not just a shout out. It's like, I see it as a collective process.
And also connecting it to things that are going on in current day. And I think that's something I'd like to hear more on, too. Folks, if you'd like to hear something about the book, give us a ring. Ask your questions, 1-800-996-2848. Ladies, we got another caller. Let's go ahead and say hello to Donna here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tuned in on KUNM. Donna, thank you for your call. And go ahead, share your thoughts.
Hi, I am a teacher, and I was really excited when I heard the upcoming program, and I'm always looking for resources to use
classroom. It's very hard to explain issues, you know, to non-natives in the classroom. And usually there's only one or two native kids in my classroom. And also my son is a native studies. He's almost major at UNM, and he's almost done. And so hopefully this will be a great resource for him also. But thank you to the authors.
All right. Thank you for your call, Donna. Here in Albuquerque, again, phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. Dina, something that our caller mentioned of having to explain, and I think going through this book, you're met with many moments living a Native life where you've had to explain some of these things. And you both even make reference to it into the book where we have to explain myths. It's a long journey. Tell me more about your hopes of how this book might take some of that pressure off of folks to always have to explain, or your thoughts on that.
I now have something I can say to somebody who challenges me, you know, on Facebook or wherever in my daily life, when these things come up, because there is always a challenge. When you talk about, you know, because we do bring the challenges in Indian country to the present, you know, there's this, you know, one of the myths is that the injustices that happened to Native people were in the past, right? And we were just talking about it this morning in the apology resolution that the United States issued a few years ago that Obama signed, right? They use the term, you know, they want to get over, like, you know, I'm just paraphrasing now, but get over like the ramifications of former wrongs. That's the term, former wrongs. So it's this way of sort of absolving themselves, the state, right? The United States, the state of America absolves itself of its former wrongs by putting it in the past. But what we do in the book is we demonstrate that those wrongs of the past is what crystallized into the system that we have now that keeps perpetuating those wrongs over and over and over again. So when I have somebody challenge me on it, I can just say, well, read the book.
And there's more details we're going to get into. We're going to take a break here, ladies. But folks, we are also inviting you into the conversation. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. I'm going to throw a couple of myths at you that are featured in the book. Columbus discovered America. What do you think about that one? Indians were savage and warlike. Anything to say on those, give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. It is our November Book of the Month. Looks like we have plenty of books left. If you'd like to get your hands on these, give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848. We are giving away 10 copies to 10 of our callers to make it on air with your questions or comments. We look forward to hearing from you, and phone lines are open.
Studying American Indian Studies in college can give people a well-rounded perspective on things like sovereignty, tribal histories, and federal policy. But then what? What value does an American Indian Studies degree offer students? We'll ask those who took that path on the next Native America Calling. We hope you'll make plans to join us.
Chris Shea. Medicare Part D is your prescription for a healthy life. Anyone with Medicare Part D provides access to affordable prescription drugs. Sign up for or switch your Part D plan during open enrollments from October 15th to December 17th. For more information, visit Medicare.gov. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Elakwa.
Support by the very first Indigenous Comic-Con in Albuquerque, New Mexico, November 18th through the 20th, featuring Indigenous creators, illustrators, writers, designers, actors, and producers from the worlds of comic books, games, sci-fi, fantasy, film, TV, and graphic novels. Indigenous Comic-Con seeks to highlight the amazing work and bring understanding about the Indigenous experience to the world of popular culture. Info on Facebook or at IndigenousComicCon.com. Everyone is welcome.
You're connected to Native America Calling. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and it's our November Book of the Month. It's great to have you as a part of this discussion. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about the book, All Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. The authors are here live in Studio 49 with us today. And in the first half, we heard some of what readers can find in the pages of this book. That is helping to unlock truth about fictions associated with Native Americans and Alaska Natives. And when it comes to myths and misconceptions about our Native nations, what extra chapter to this book could you write? And what myth about your tribe or corporation would you like to see busted? Join the conversation at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And 10 people who participate on air will get a copy of the book, thanks to Beacon Press. And here with us, it's our pleasure to welcome back Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. She's a historian, author, and editor, and she's also the recipient of the 2015 American Book Award. She is well known throughout American Indian Studies, and it is our pleasure to have her here with us. Welcome back, Roxanne. Also with us, too, we have Dina Gilio Whitaker. This Colville writer is also known for her work with Indian Country Today Media Network, and she is currently a research associate and associate scholar at the Center for Indigenous Studies. And it is our pleasure to welcome both of you back. And ladies, what brings you directly to Studio 49 is you are on, I can only imagine what this trip is like, where you started in one part of the country and you are making your way across it on a book tour, over a dozen places. You're stopping and talking about this book. You also have an event this evening as well. And so ladies, where can people follow your trek and maybe even connect with you directly as you make your way across the nation?
We have a Facebook page called All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, and we try to keep it updated with our travels. So find us there, and we do, yeah, so we're trying to keep that up to date. And yeah, we're just, we started in the Bay Area. Roxanne lives in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I live in Southern California. So we've done a couple events there, and we're really at the beginning of this tour. We started in Tempe, Arizona a couple of days ago. This is our second stop, and then we're on our way to Oklahoma, and then Tahlequah, and then Seattle and Portland, and then we got stops in the Midwest later in the month, and then in the East Coast in December.
And this evening, you're going to be at Bookworks here in Albuquerque.
Yeah, we're going to be at Bookworks in Albuquerque, which is, let me find the address. It is 4022 Rio Grande Boulevard, and 6 o'clock.
All right, there you go.
And tonight and this afternoon, we're at SIPI, the Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute.
Yeah.
And that's at 2 o'clock and in the library at SIPI.
Well, you have a full day, and I'm glad you're spending part of it with us. There are people who are also glad, and they've called in to tell us about it. Let's go ahead and take another call. We're going to say hello to Tony in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Tony, thank you for giving us a ring. And what would you like to know?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the purpose of the book, but you covered that real good. But I was going to ask you about, in Arizona, it's in the White Mountain, Apache land. It's a cave called Geronimo's Cave. And I've seen the entry of the cave and supposed to travel from that point to Cibicue, Arizona, which is like 30 miles from that point. And I'm assuming that people used to live in that cave for short periods of time. And not too far from that cave, it's a, within a mountain, it's a formation like, and you can see it.
And Tony, I'm sure there's people who know exactly where you're talking about. And Tony, what are you wondering specifically about the book?
Yeah, I was trying to relate that to that. What would be the purpose of that, those stories, and how would that apply to the book?
I think that's a very important question. When you look at the pre-colonial networks of exchange, trade, carrying religious items, for instance, here in New Mexico, people use abalone in ceremonies. There's no abalone nearby. All of that indicate there's abalone, there's turquoise up in the Great Lakes area, items that don't exist there and here, and all over the whole hemisphere, there were a network of roads which were appropriated. Even the interstate highway system follows those same roads. They're along coasts, they're along riverways. And what that indicates is that people have always had contact with each other and change. You know, they're dynamic people. So that one of the ideas or the myths is, besides, you know, disappearance, is that everything stood still. So this, all the real Indians died off. A part of that is that if Native people aren't perceived as doing what is perceived to be their traditional, whatever they were doing in 1607 when Jamestown was founded, they're supposed to be doing that same thing then, but they would have changed. They would be different now, obviously. So it's almost dehumanizing and freezing in time. So that's how you come up with, well, these aren't real Indians. These people who are, you know, at Standing Rock and standing up and hiding, those aren't real Indians because they're not behaving in the same way. But, you know, in many ways they are. Resistance is resistance. There are different forms at different times. But they're still fighting for their land, still fighting for their cultures and their languages. But also there are different times. There's different the adversary changes. So you have to confront it as it is. So this quality of dynamism, I think, is something that's left out when anthropologists look at the past. They see these things as, or archaeologists, as frozen items of antiquity. And these antiquity, I know I've gone with Native people to Mesa Verde, whose ancestors are from there. To them, it's ancestral homeland. It's not some frozen. They see the continuity with the present. It's their history. But to others who go look, it's just something of the past. It doesn't have people in it. People are absent.
And it brings into focus one of the threads throughout the book that you'll find is the concept of authenticity, right? And that's why we use the term real in the title, Real Indians, right? It implies the fact that Indians are always being judged for being who they are or who they're not based on this, as Roxanne said, this cultural stasis, right? This staying frozen in a romanticized past. And that romanticized past means that people that are Native today can't be seen as authentic.
And I'm sure there's people who related to what you just said as well. Folks, if there's anything you'd like to share, 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we appreciate all the calls and the questions and comments. As you can hear, this book relates to a lot that is going on, even what we're witnessing today in our Native nations. Let's take another call. We're going to hear now from John in Nespelem, Washington, tuned in online. John, thank you for your call, and go ahead and share your thoughts.
Good morning. You might as well say that the question is already answered, but I'll just make a comment first. We have a brother in South Dakota. When he was asked, are there any true, not Indians, but true traditionalists left? Mm-hmm. And his comment was, and he's a fluent speaker of Lakota, and he said, no, not really. There's not really very many true traditionalists left because they don't go through all the ceremonies, don't speak fluent language, and don't think first in Lakota instead of, you know, in English. And is that what you mean by the title of the book, Real Indians or Real Traditionalists?
All right. Thank you for that. And ladies, your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, that destruction, intentional destruction through the boarding schools of native languages, I don't think it means that people haven't kept the thought patterns passed on through stories, especially even when they're enunciated in English. But what is most beautiful in the last 20, 25 years is the language revival, that developing some written languages, computers help in that sense of linguists, native people who are becoming linguists, like Michael Yellowbird's brother, Anna Rickera, who was a consultant for the film The Reverent, which was about half the film was in Arikara. And that just shows the power. That language was almost gone. You know, there were almost no speakers of it because of the devastation of the Arikara. And so I think that there's a dynamism in that, that doesn't at all say that I wouldn't define. I was hoping you would say that that person who was being asked that question said, you're looking at one. You know, I'm in the tradition of my elders. We're having to repair a lot of things that were lost or regain them. But yeah, I'm one. I'm traditionalist. And for you know, all Native people say, I'm a traditionalist. That's what I am. I'm a part of a continuing culture.
Thank you for that, Roxanne. I got another caller. We're going to go to Salem, Oregon to talk to a caller who's on line 7. Listening online in Salem. I'm not sure how you pronounce this, but I'm going to take a stab at this. Hello, Mayoff.
Thank you. You got that. First of all, I want to compliment the authors for taking a bold step in getting information out there to correct history. We know there's so many myths out there today. And secondly, my question is, I know our public school systems are the gateway to teaching our young children of all cultures. And I'm thinking this book will be a wonderful book for a public school system. And of all the things that are taught about Native people, it's always not correct. And there's a lot of confusion in our public schools, I've noticed over the course of my children attending school. But one specific question is about the land bridge theory that's taught in schools. Does the book address the land bridge theory? And of course, the Native people always believed that we were here. The Creator put us here. So I'll just listen for your answer offline. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. Well, you're going to be happy because it is addressed in the book. You couldn't leave that one out. Let me just tell you, folks, these two ladies started to smile really big when our caller mentioned this. Go ahead, your comments.
There's a whole chapter, as Tara said. What do we call a chapter?
Natives are anti-scientists. Anti-science.
Well, oh, yeah. Well, there's that one. Yeah. And then we have another chapter about Indians being the first immigrants.
Right.
There's a narrative about that gets thrown around in some circles by some people who say that, you know, Indians are just the first colonists, really, you know, the first people to settle here. And there's all kinds of problems with that narrative. But we do take it on pretty head on. Because there's it's a huge controversy, you know. Over there's a pattern in the last few years that is breaking down that myth that Native people came across the Bering Strait, and we point out that the Bering Strait and Vine Deloria, you know, our grandfather of Native studies, he was the one that really, in his book Red Earth, White Lies, I mean, he was the one that really, you know, brought this out in such a forceful and important way, and so we draw on Vine Deloria for that, but also the work of Alex Ewan. He's an important scholar. He's done so much work, and he's been published a lot at Indian Country Today for the work that he's done to break that myth down. But it comes down to the fact that the Bering Strait land bridge theory was never more than a theory, and it's a theory that was repeated so many times that it became fact, right? I mean, there's this, you know, we hear that, you know, repeat a lie enough times and it becomes truth. And that's the same with the land bridge theory. So we take it apart as much as we can in, you know, 10 pages or so to demonstrate that it's really a dying theory. And there were, you know, we know that there were multiple migrations that came from, you know, the north, but also from the Pacific. People came from the Pacific way before the Europeans ever came here. They came from the south. So there were these multiple migrations that happened over thousands and thousands of years. And
the refusal to study it, or their lack, you know, the National Science Foundation, which is the main conduit for funding for, you know, archaeology and science in general, without that kind of funding, it's not like, you know, writing a book where you just need a pen and paper. You have to have equipment. You have to have travel money. You have to have living money. You have to have crews. It's like making a film, you know. It's expensive. And there is no research money for exploring migrations to the Western Hemisphere, or the original settlement of the Western Hemisphere. It doesn't exist. So anyone doing this work is really doing it on their own or theorizing from work already done that gets interpreted, because even some of the groundwork I went through for a book I wrote about the history of land tenure in New Mexico, Roots of Resistance, it was actually my dissertation, 1974, I went through all of the existing archaeology and their interpretations, and I found enough evidence just as a layperson, not a scientist, in those books to come up with completely different conclusions than they come up with.
You know, just hearing that, Roxanne, it would be interesting if, you know, our tribal nations
absolutely
took on this
no
quest
money.
To kind
That's
of
what
take
we
a
need.
Look at this. We got another caller we're going to bring in. Let's go ahead and say hello to Diane in Anchorage, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Diane, thank you for your call, and you're on air.
Thank you so much, and good morning, everyone. I wanted to, I've been following Roxanne's writings for a really long time, and I appreciate your ability to put that in context that I can use as I educate non-Native people who are working in the field of child advocacy, and I do a lot of work training like court-appointed special advocates, just especially court system people who oftentimes are willing to go read a book somewhere, but just don't know where to look and don't know what's credible. So I just want to thank you and appreciate this new resource that I can use to help educate others.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for that. We're going to go now to Anthony in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM on line 8. Anthony, you're
yes,
on air.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Yes, I'm going to point this out to one of the authors. I grew up in Richmond, California, back in the 60s, 50s. My parents were relocated out there, you know, during the war and had jobs. But, you know, during the time when they were out there, they took their religion with them. They had ceremonial dances out there that they kept up throughout all the way up to the early 60s at the time. And when I moved back out here to New Mexico, you know, I learned about that, and I teach my children about that and teach my grandchildren about that. as your as the earlier caller was mentioned about traveling, and the author was talking about traveling and migration, you know, I find a lot of petroglyphs out on our reservation that has not been discovered, and you can see that in the petroglyph drawings, you can see the traveling that they have done, and I'm glad this book is long overdue. I kind of confused what I'm saying, but thank you very much.
All right,
thank
Anthony,
you.
Thank you for your call.
That, let me follow up just a second on that. It's amazing because the Laguna Acoma people were had an agreement for giving, you know, a bunch of land to the railroad, that they got priority for jobs on the railroad and passes for their families to travel. So they Richmond was the end point of the Santa Fe Rail, and they built kivas there even in the 1920s. It's 1920s and 1930s, so I don't know if this person is a descendant of that or they came later, but when relocation happened and the Bay Area was 50,000 Native people came there, there was already existing a platform, you know, for to really keep the cultures going. It was really quite beautiful.
Thanks, Roxanne. We're going to take another call. Let's go ahead and say hello to Michael in Anchorage, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Michael, thank you for giving us a ring. And what would you like to tell our authors?
Hi. I'm really glad to hear that you're addressing these myths, because there's so many that just get, oh, yeah, I'm right. When somebody hears something, is, you know, to help kids understand that everything you hear in school and history books is not correct. I heard of one first grade student whose teacher sent a note home. His mother's have a meeting because she's very concerned about this misconception the kid had about what happened to their people in history. And the mother says, "Well, around our house, we call that the truth." So it's nice to have the source.
Thanks, Michael. You know, just hearing you take us to that point, Michael, I made the comment as I was reading this to my family that if I had this book when I was 10, I think it would have saved me a lot of breath and got people to understand more. Michael, thank you for your call there in Anchorage. We're going to take one more as we're getting close to the end of the hour. This one is going by really fast. Let's go ahead and say hello to Gary in Winnipeg, Canada, tuned in online. Gary, thank you for your call. And go ahead, share your thoughts.
Everybody over that way.
Hello. Go ahead. You're on air.
Yes. I would just like to say that I worked at the museum here in Manitoba. And I worked down away from everybody else, and I was reading it. And they were talking about Aboriginal people, the skis, snowshoes developed on both sides of the ocean. But the Europeans went into skis, and the Aboriginal people went into snowshoes. Working in there, so I went over to the anthropologist, archaeologist, and I asked them, why is it that our people developed snowshoes and they developed skis? And they said, that's because you people didn't have the technology.
Oh.
So I went back and I started thinking about that for a while. I went back to them, I says, well, you know, there's a lot of technology in snowshoes, because there's different kinds of snowshoes depending on the kind of work and that you're doing. If you're in the plains, if you're in the bush, whatever. Different types of snows, you use different types of webbing, which to me takes a lot of technology. I said, but if you take about four or five skis, you put them side by side and you latch them together and that, you put a string on it, and that's called a toboggan. So our people in reality had the technology, but they used it differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, and I thought, well, why is that? And then I looked at a picture of a ski resort, and I saw someone walking with a pair of crutches, and I said, well, maybe that's why our people develop snowshoes and not skis.
It's smarter. That's a good one, Gary. Thanks for your call there in Winnipeg. And ladies, you'll have to relay that one to your talk at Sippy today.
Yes, exactly.
Any comments? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to, you know, the underlying narrative, saying that your people didn't have technology. That's a way of saying in so many words that that Native people were inferior. And that's really another one of the threads in this book is that we make visible is the narrative of inferiority that's been built into the settler colonial system that keeps natives is frozen in the past, that keeps us seen as not authentic, that we're inferior because we didn't have the right technology. We didn't, use the wheel. We didn't, fill in the blank. And so it plays out in all these things. And we have a chapter on that we call Indians are Anti-Science. And so we talk about all that, and we bring to light the technology that Native people did develop, agricultural systems, complex irrigation systems, astronomy, and lots of other things.
Well, ladies, that's going to have to wrap up the hour. We're just scratching on the surface here, and I'm glad that there is so much more to explore as well. Folks, if you do want to connect with either of them, we have links on the website to the book, and also mentioned in the hour, you can find them on Facebook too. And if you're in the Albuquerque area, they are at Sippy today, as well as Bookworks. And they're making their trek across the nation. And folks, when you do receive your complimentary copy of the book, if there's something you want to tell us about something you read, something you'd like to hear more on, feel free to reach out to us. You can always send us an email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And thanks again to both of these ladies who have joined us here in studio. Thanks again to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Dina Giglio-Whitaker, and also thanks to Beacon Press for providing copies of the book. We hope you'll join us again on Monday as we take a look at American Indian Studies programs and why students are stepping into this path. Thanks to our crew here at Native America Calling, our executive producer, Art Hughes, senior producer, Monica Brain, associate producer, Andy Murphy, and also thanks to Roman Garcia for engineering today's show. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we will be back on Monday.
Support for this program provided by the University of Tulsa College of Law, offering a 100% online master's degree program in Indian law. This degree can move your career forward and help you work effectively in Indian country. Deadline for spring application is December 1st. Info at law.utulsa.edu/MJIL. As an American Indian or Alaska Native, there is one simple thing you can do to help your elders, help young people seeking an education, and help develop Native businesses. Exercise your right to vote for the candidates of your choice on November 8th. Your vote on Election Day makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Vote for our people, our land, and our future. Know your rights and go to NativeAmericaCalling.com for more information. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.